Mission 5, Operation Winterfest. When the Deedlit Satori Mandeville Memorial Institute was established on the Bajoran moon of Jurado, one of its stated goals had been to retain all of WPI's best traditions, while at the same time using our unique location and opportunities to forge new ones. Traditions such as homecoming, the spring formal, and the spring recital had made the transition without too much trouble. New traditions also sprang up, such as the end-of-summer party at Betrell Beach in late August, and the rolling of the Gumbug on the commons in the middle of May. But one tradition that nobody was keen on resuming was the effects of the much-dreaded sea term. Initially, the school calendar had stayed much the same as it had been at WPI. Four quarters, separated by recesses of varying lengths. This, however, left a major chunk of uninterrupted time in the middle of sea term, which when compounded by the Jaradar Valley winter was a sure recipe for emotional disaster. One couldn't count on a repeat occurrence of the Great Blizzard of 06 to shut down the school for an extra week, after all. But the administration, after seeing the higher-than-average C-term exam scores after the unintended interruption back in 2406, decided after long deliberation that it might be time to try something different. Recognizing a good thing when they saw it, they decided to codify the break in the schedule as a recuperative recess. With the chance to catch their metaphorical breath, the faculty hoped that the students would enter the rest of C-term and the term's final exams mentally refreshed. The students, however, didn't worry about the educational theory underpinnings of the mid-C-term break. All they cared about was the fact that it worked, and they had a much more succinct name for it. They called it Sanity Week. Monday, February 8th, 2410. Deedlit Satori Mandeville Memorial Institute. Jurado, Republic of Bajor. At the rate she was going, Kaname Sterling thought she would lose her sanity before the titular week arrived. She hadn't technically been tasked with managing absolutely everything to do with Winterfest. Nominally, she was the chairwoman of the Winterfest Committee, which meant her official function was to designate various committee members to handle various tasks and then sit back and bask in the reflected glory, or watch them take the fall if they didn't get their jobs done. This was the way such committees had always been run. It was an accepted part of the structure of life in any democratic or even pseudo-democratic society. Unfortunately, delegating and sitting back was not in Kaname's nature, and so she delegated and then suffered approximately 140... plus is positive, minus is negative, oh let me! Moments per hour, until the other committee members wisely adapted their roles. By a sort of silent consensus, they shifted from planning to execution and just let General Sterling handle the top-level details. By midday on Monday, she'd commandeered the Hamlin 4 lounge as a sort of Winterfest war room and ensconced herself in the corner from which the TV couldn't be seen, surrounded by folding tables and documents. This wasn't Kaname's first Winterfest. She'd had a tremendous amount of fun at 2409's Winter Sports Gala. But she hadn't appreciated just how much effort went into organizing these things, and she mentally cursed that part of her that couldn't help but to plan and coordinate when others seemed unwilling to do it. "This thing looks a whole lot different from the other side of the planning table," she sighed to herself. "As usual." "Did you say something, my not quite as tallest?" asked a small green figure who had been watching the TV in the other part of the lounge. "No, not really, Zach. It's nothing. Go back to what you were doing." "Yes, my not quite as tallest," saluted her floor's Irken student, who then returned to watching the Food Network special on the making of cream-filled cakes. Shaking her head, she returned her focus to the planned schedule of activities she was working on. ice skating on Lake Jaridar with the sideline of some impromptu hockey? Better check with May and Steinberg to see what the progress was in making the lake safe to skate on. Ice boating competition on Crow Reservoir? Better send an email to Hammond and Clarkson. Make sure they're still on track for getting the venue set up and that the safety measures are in place, and that the teams are ready with their entries. Sledding down Castle Hill? Check in with Boba Fett. Make sure they're still cool with the Sprogs doing that. Organize snowball fights. Make sure Sakumizu is keeping Sugiura from slacking off and instead setting up the snowball fight arenas on the practice fields. The bonfire on Saturday night. Coordinate with campus security, the campus fire department, and plant services to make sure that everything was provided and safe for the still accumulating burnables pile in the middle of the commons. And then, finally, get everything lined up, food, facilities, and entertainment, for the Winterfest dance on Sunday evening. Reaching that line item, Kaname hesitated. It was called the Winterfest dance, but really, everybody knew what its real purpose was, no matter how much the school tried to non-denominationalize it. It was a Valentine's Day dance, pure and simple, and everybody knew it. The organization of the dance itself wasn't the issue for Kaname. Some of the work had already been done by the Student Activities Office. As Nao Zhang had predicted, the Art of Noise was scheduled to perform Sunday evening in the Jer Johnson Student Union Ballroom. Food would be provided by campus dining in association with some of the students. She'd already tasked her friend Shuri Kudo to oversee that. Decorations would be supplied by the theater department. Maya Mukai and Mizuki Inaba were handling that task. No, the problem was what it represented. Kaname was of two minds about the entire holiday and its trappings. On the one hand, it was nice to have an extra holiday to celebrate close connections to loved ones, and she had a lot of loved ones in her extended family to celebrate with. In fact, one of her aunts on her father's side was even born on Valentine's Day, which reminded her she'd need to get a card for her and mail it out. Which suited that aunt's temperament to a T. She definitely didn't begrudge the couples that she knew on campus having a special day to celebrate, even if they were relentlessly cheerful the day after the event. But on the other hand, as depressing as it was to dwell on it, Kaname Chittery Sterling hadn't had much romance, trademark, in her life so far. Oh, she thought about it off and on. What girl her age didn't? And occasionally fantasized about what it would be like to have a special someone to rely upon like that. But so far, the reality was leaving something to be desired. Her attempts at dating during her freshman year at Jindai High, often by the suggestion of her friends there, had been an almost comedic series of failures, though she hadn't thought they were all that funny at the time. Before she'd left Jindai High at the end of her freshman year, she had gained the reputation of the hottest girl at school that you wouldn't want to date. And she had to admit this was partly her fault. She knew she wasn't the easiest person to deal with when she got going, but that's the way she was raised, to speak her mind and be proactive. But then again, the quality of the dates she had gone on had been notably subpar in her estimation, and she was not above complaining about it. She didn't want to hear a guy go on about whatever the hell it was special about his life. She wanted to know what he thought of the world and their place in it. Spirit, was that too much to ask of the male of the species these days? Ever since coming to the Institute, Kaname had pretty much stopped trying to look for that special someone. She wouldn't turn down such a thing if offered or found, but only if it was sincere. And there were plenty around, like Mizuki's old boyfriend, the two-timing snake, who didn't even make it past the first evaluation. You'd need to be pretty determined and sure of yourself to try and date a Sterling anyway, and so far nobody that she thought might make the cut had dared to try. If this kept up, she might well have to take matters into her own hands, if only to quash the rumors that had started flying about herself and the military menace. Of course, it didn't help matters that as part of the terms of his probationary release, Sosuke Sagara had been seconded to the student council as a sergeant-at-arms, to be tasked with any duties, no matter how low, that the council deemed fit. It was meant to serve as a long-duration detention, and a member of the student government was to keep watch on his activities at all times. While theoretically this was meant to be a punishment detail, it was a going question for Kaname as to whom it was a punishment for. Speaking of Sosuke, where the hell was he, anyway? Felina Clan, I would have a word with you. Kaname lifted her head, and then the rest of her body, to look over the table's edge. Before her stood a rotund figure, a Volus in its pressurized encounter suit, and if the blinking of its translator lights were any indication, this particular Volus was pretty irate. Hey, John. What can I do for you? Have you seen this student campus defense plan your pet soldier is working on? Student Council Treasurer John Orlon demanded, brandishing a datapad. He's just forwarded me a draft outline. I'll take that as a no, John said, tossing the datapad onto the table. You might familiarize yourself with it. It's diverting reading. Barking mad diverting, but diverting nonetheless. It would probably work, I'm no security expert. But I can tell you this, it would bankrupt the student council. It would require using up all the council funds, not just those allocated for Winterfest, but all of them for the rest of the fiscal year, and borrowing against the appropriation for the next fiscal year. The Volus accounting student paused to take a deep, labored breath from his respirator, then blustered on. If my calculations are correct, and I have no reason to doubt that they are, we can say goodbye to all our spring events and next fall's homecoming. The Halloween gala, maybe even the Yule Ball. It would be a catastrophe of Wisterian proportions. Kaname was genuinely worried that the treasurer was going to blow a seal by this point. So when he next stopped for breath, she said, Hey, easy there, John. It's just a draft, right? He hasn't started, you know, building anything. No, and he won't, as long as I'm treasurer of the council. John replied, Such errant fiscal irresponsibility is exactly the sort of thing I'm here to prevent. Student campus defense? Who ever heard of such a thing? John shook his head. I fear for your boyfriend's safety, Chittery. He's not my boyfriend, and don't call me Chittery, Kaname replied automatically. People had taken to doing both things lately. The first was annoying, and the second slightly baffling, but apparently had something to do with Sosuke's persistent use of the name. She rubbed wearily at her eyes for a second, muttering to herself, He screws up, and I am the one who gets the complaints? When I said this stuff about leashes, I didn't mean it to be so literal. Still grumbling, Kaname got up to get her coat. Okay, come with me. Let's get to the bottom of this. They found Sosuke in one of the engineering simulation labs in Spencer, tinkering with the details of what was, in fact, an extremely elaborate plan of checkpoints, earthworks, barricades, and weapons emplacements. Standing speechless in the middle of about a quarter's acre of scaled-down holographic campus, Kaname slowly turned and took it all in, remembering half-buried lessons in the military arts from her mother, aunts, and various relations. She wasn't an expert either by any means, but even to her unpracticed eye it seemed evident that Sosuke's plan, if implemented, would convert the campus into a makeshift but effective fortress. All right, I'm impressed, John Orlon admitted. Are you sure your friend is not part Turian, Kaname Chittery? Of course, it's still entirely out of the question. Far too costly. And I doubt we would even be able to get possession of... He peered through his encounter suit's optics at the identifying tag on the nearest weapons emplacement, EWHB. An E-wub, whatever that may happen to be. Turning, he added airily, Well, I have a class to get to. I leave it to you, and stumped out. Thanks, said Kaname wryly. Then, turning to Sosuke, she said, Okay, explain. It's a campus security augmentation plan, Sosuke told her. It's all in my report. What possessed you to think we needed something like that? Kaname demanded. This is a school, not an Outer Rim pirate fort. I've been considering the matter since the incident with Professors Clarkson and May, Sosuke replied at once. That was a false alarm, but the central problem remains. In the event of an actual incursion, this campus would be hopelessly exposed, practically indefensible except for the castle, and falling back to that one strong point is not practical for the entire student body. He toggled a couple of holographic keys on the Sim Suite's control module and reverted the campus holomap to its original configuration. Particularly in light of this weekend's planned activities. Look, there is a distinct lack of perimeter control in the entire athletic complex for both the participants and the spectators. This is doubly evident in the vicinity of Lake Jaradar and Crow Reservoir. It would be very simple for a determined attacker to duplicate or even exceed the results of the Species Separation League terrorist attack on the 2386 Winter Olympics. We're just trying to set up some winter sporting events for the kids, Kaname declared with a frustrated gesture. Not trying to make a fortress to rival Queen Azrael's palace. Sosuke frowned thoughtfully. Actually, the Palace Imperial in Sanar is not nearly as secure as you would think. That's not the point! Kaname roared, cutting him off. He stood and regarded her silently while she took a few deep breaths to regain control of herself, then offered in an unaggressive tone. The scenario is not as far-fetched as you seem to believe. Our neighbors, the Xavier Institute, came under armed attack by elements of the Big Fire Terror Syndicate just last December. What? Sosuke nodded. Several of the duelists participated in repelling the assault, along with a number of high-level IPO operatives. Big Fire's aim seems to have been the abduction of a number of students. I thought that was a drill or something, Kaname objected. That was the public cover story. The authorities wished to forestall the possibility of a panic here, since the incident was not directly linked to this school. In light of which, I acknowledge that the Xavier Institute student body as a whole has certain qualities that make it a more attractive target for such operations than DSM's. Regardless, I still believe such a strike isn't entirely inconceivable here. And as matters currently stand, we would be hard-pressed to defend ourselves. Kaname regarded him for a few seconds, as if trying to decide whether he was out of his mind or the galaxy was. She was on the verge of telling him to get hold of himself and forget the whole thing, when what he'd just told her combined with the memory of another recent conversation to give her pause. Tuesday, February 2nd, 2410, 4:35 p.m. A disciplinary hearing in Main Administration wasn't where Kaname wanted to spend her afternoon today, but she didn't have much choice. Any hearings that could possibly lead to expulsion required, at the minimum, the Institute's president, the chief of campus security, the dean of student life, the student council president, and the head of the resident advisor council in attendance, or any of their duly appointed deputies. Given the suddenness of the meeting, Shizuru Viola, the current Resident Advisor Council president, was unable to forfeit her classes for the afternoon, so she had sent a quick text message to the one who had a much larger stake in the proceedings, namely Kaname Sterling, and deputized her to attend in her stead. Privately, Kaname wondered if Shizuru hadn't had an ulterior motive in shifting the job onto her, but for the life of her she couldn't figure out what that motive would be. Now, Sosuke was standing at attention in the center of the meeting room, his expression inscrutable as usual. To her left sat Dean Montaigne, who had a worried look on her face. Next to the dean sat President Tiefeld, who gave off a feeling of concerned disappointment. Beyond the president was Constable Odo, his face, insofar as Kaname could tell, grim and without humor. The only person in the room who did not appear to be worried about the proceedings was the person sitting on Kaname's right. Atsunobu Hayashimizu, the student council president, was an intelligent young man who never seemed to be surprised by anything going on around him. Now it was Hayashimizu who spoke first, his tone calm and reasonable as it always was. "Ladies and gentlemen, let's dispense with the formalities, if you please. We're all busy people, and besides, the particulars of this case are not in question. Sergeant Sakura does not deny that he embarked on an unauthorized paramilitary adventure with the Institute's RK-92 arm slave earlier today." The school officials looked at each other in puzzlement, as if to ask each other, "Then what are we doing here?" President Tiefeld looked through his notes for a moment, then asked Hayashimizu, "Then am I to take it that he intends to present no defense?" "On the contrary, Mr. President," said Hayashimizu with a smile. Or rather, he corrected himself with a wry glance at Sosuke's stolid countenance. "I expect he does so intend, but I mean to present one for him. You see, as I view the matter, we're not here to determine whether he did that thing, but rather to determine how he should be punished for it, and I contend that he should not be."
"That's an interesting point of view, Mr. Hayashimizu," said Odo dryly. "I'm eager to hear how you plan to elaborate on it."
Hayashimizu reached into his uniform jacket and withdrew a small book with a maroon cover, which he placed on the table in front of him and opened to a previously marked place. "I refer the board to Section 13, Paragraph 4 of the Student Code of Conduct. The safety and security of the campus is everybody's responsibility. The Institute's professional staff depends on the student body's vigilance and engagement to help them." Looking up from the book, the council president went on reasonably, "The sergeant merely operates at a higher level of awareness than the average student." Holding up a hand to forestall comment, he conceded, "I grant you, his approach to dealing with the situation was unusually proactive, not to say precipitous, but put yourselves in his position. He's here to do a job, as you are all aware, one in which he's been confirmed by arrangement with Miss Sterling and the Office of Campus Security. No one had notified him of the plans Professors Clarkson and May had for the school's Panzer 26, nor even that the school had a Panzer 26, plainly a critical oversight. I ask you, what is a young man with his training and inclination to do upon unexpectedly sighting an armored fighting vehicle, one with foreign military markings, no less, operating on campus?" Odo opened his mouth to make a sarcastic remark, but Hayashimizu timed his rhetorical pause perfectly and continued a nanosecond before he could have been accused of interrupting the constable. So far as he knew, the Institute was under attack. So far as he knew, there was no time to alert the professionals. So far as he knew, only one person in that part of the campus had the skills and access to the tools necessary to deal with the situation. Himself. The student officer shook his head. Taking action as he did was the only reasonable thing he could do under the circumstances. Kaname stared at the young man in blank disbelief for a moment, then turned to see how the review board were taking it. Odo raised an eyebrow and glanced skeptically to his left, then his right. On either side of him, President Tiefeld and Dean Montaigne were looking past him to regard each other with expressions of carefully masked amusement. The constable saw which way the wind was blowing and sighed, his shoulders sagging.
"You make a unique point, Mr. Hayashimizu," said Dean Montaigne. "Surely, though, you see that Sergeant Sagara's zeal can't be left without direction."
"Certainly," Hayashimizu agreed at once. "However, I put it to the board that his abilities and his vigilance are not only desirable, but necessary to the safety of the Institute. These are dangerous times in the galaxy. No one, I think, will dispute that. Recent events practically in our own backyard speak to that. Now more than ever, we need someone like Sosuke Sagara among us.
I suppose you think I should hire him,
Odo grumbled.
Not at all, said Hayashimizu smoothly. He's a student, and a student he must remain.
Which is why I propose that he be designated sergeant-at-arms to the student council.
I beg your pardon? Said President Tiefeld after a startled pause.
Turning to another marked page in his copy of the student handbook, Hayashimizu adjusted his spectacles and said, According to Article 4 of the student government's charter, such a post has always existed, but we've never seen fit to fill it before. With the Duelist Society on campus, I suppose that to my predecessors there seemed little need, but I think we can all agree that Sergeant Sagara is a slightly different breed of cat, he added with a slight smile. He closed the book, folded his hands atop it, and concluded, We have a vacancy for someone with security experience. The sergeant needs a bit of direction. Under this arrangement, both are provided. Everyone wins. Odo glanced at Tiefeld and Montaigne again, saw that they were obviously impressed with the young man's arguments, and lodged one last objection, more or less for form's sake.
Does your charter say who's supposed to supervise your sergeant-at-arms?
Like most matters internal to the student government, it's left to the discretion of the executive officers, Hayashimizu replied, unruffled. The ultimate responsibility, of course, rests with me, but in order to best avoid causing the sergeant any conflict of interest, I propose to delegate day-to-day oversight to Miss Sterling. So calm, persuasive, and logical were Hayashimizu's arguments that Kaname caught herself nodding in agreement. Yeah, that does make the most sense. Before the meaning of his words fully sank in, at which point she turned to him and snapped, What? Kaname sighed deeply, rubbing a hand down her face, and then said, Well, we can't build this. It'd bankrupt the council. John was furious. So, wrap it up, put it all in a final report, and send it to Odo, with copies to Hayashimizu and President Tiefeld's office. I don't think the administration will have any interest in turning the school into an armed camp, but if anybody's going to make that decision, it's them, not us, and then they can pay for it. She sighed again. Okay? Sosuke nodded. As you say. He raised up his alterations to the map again and set to work, adding finishing touches and cleaning up the presentation. Kaname watched him at it for a few seconds, then asked wryly, Man, what were you like in kindergarten? King of the Sandbox must have been an exercise in generalship with you around. Sosuke paused for a moment, turned to regard her without much of any expression, then said, I wouldn't know, and returned to work. Wow, that was dumb. Can't believe I did that. Kaname grumbled to herself, and left him to it. It wasn't as though she didn't have work of her own to be doing, after all. Tuesday, February 9th, 2410. Tuesday afternoon found Kaname setting up a sort of temporary backup war room in Hamlin Hall's ground floor lounge. This was not because she'd been turned out of the one up on the fourth floor, but because she'd arrived back at the building an hour or so before dinner and couldn't be arsed to go up, only to come back down in an hour. Instead, she spread out the paperwork she had with her, which mainly had to do with event scheduling, and worked quietly at it while she waited for the metaphorical dinner bell. So engrossed was she in this that she didn't notice Sosuke, sitting in the corner of the room, where the sight lines were best to the windows and the archway leading out into the corridor, at all. That was fine with him. His tasking did not require her attention, only her presence. In ways, it was easier when she didn't interact with him. 5 times in the last 20 minutes, his vigil had been interrupted not by anything Kaname did,
but by other students passing by the room, noticing him, and coming in to speak to him. This was unusual, bordering on anomalous. He was normally much more successful at blending into the background, at least when tactical exigencies didn't force him to take the kind of action that automatically became something of a spectacle. Not today, though. Today, no fewer than 7 classmates had approached him while Kaname, oblivious, labored at her paperwork. He was still frowning in contemplation of the phenomenon when she reached some kind of endpoint, sat back in the couch, and gave an exasperated sigh, then noticed him. The look on his face must have caught her attention because she abandoned whatever she'd been about to say and asked instead, "What's eating you?" Sosuke considered keeping the matter to himself, but as any situation in which he became involved stood a better than even chance of involving Kaname, he decided that would have been unfair. So he replied, "I'm unsure. I think there may be some sort of conspiracy developing that involves an unsettling number of our classmates." Kaname gave him a more wary than normal look. Explain? "Since we have been sitting here, 7 of our classmates who would not normally go out of their way to speak to me have come into this room specifically to seek me out and ask me a question. The same question. This is beyond the bounds of reasonable coincidence. My supposition? They were all put up to it by the same unknown third party, most likely for purposes of distracting me and achieving some kind of infiltration." "Huh. And what question would that be?" "Whatever their purpose may be, it seems that it would be served by my attending the Winterfest dance." Sosuke shook his head thoughtfully. "Most peculiar." Kaname's look shifted more toward the are-you-for-real end of the spectrum. "These classmates, would they happen to have been girls?" "Not that there's anything wrong with it if they weren't," she added hastily, her cheeks going a bit red. "I just, 7 of them, that's not statistically... Never mind. Anyway..." "They were," Sosuke replied. "Though I don't see..." Kaname dropped her forehead into her palm. "Spirit, you are dense," she said. "They weren't asking you to just go to the dance. They were asking you to go to the dance with them. On a date? Imbecile." "Oh. This would be a purely recreational function?" "Yeah, they usually are." "Then in your estimation, it isn't part of a distraction operation for some as yet unknown tactical expediency?" No. "Well, probably not. Who were they?" Sosuke looked at Kaname intently as he listed off the names. "Ena Saiki, now Zhang, Maya Mukai, Jessica Albrecht, Haruka Suzushiro, Mizuki Inaba, and Nelina of Thessia." "Yeah, I don't think anybody on that list is strategic conspiracy material. Except maybe Inaba, she's treacherous," said Kaname with a little smile. "I'll make a note of that," Sosuke deadpanned, and Kaname genuinely couldn't tell whether he was serious. Then he said, "You seemed exasperated. Was the unexpected room traffic disturbing you?" "Huh? Oh, no. Actually, I didn't even notice that. It's just that I noticed I have a huge hole in Sunday's schedule. From lunchtime until the dance, there's bupkis. I could double up some of the stuff from Saturday, weather permitting, but that would be kind of lame. I hate repeating myself." Sosuke looked interested. "How much of a time span are we talking about?" 4 or 5 hours, Kaname replied. "Say from 12:30 till dark, or maybe a bit past, depending on what was going on. It'd have to wrap up by 5 o'clock or so either way, so everyone would have time to get some supper and change for the dance." She spread out the papers again and surveyed them glumly. "The ice boating is going to be all done Saturday. I suppose we could just do more snowball fights, but I mean, how many snowball fights can we have? We're not 6 years old anymore. That kind of thing gets old. Sosuke gave a decisive nod. It's not a problem, he said firmly. Leave it to me. Kaname blinked. Seriously? Seriously. I'll take care of it. Okay, well, thanks. Out in the hall, students started passing in small groups, bound for the dining common. Kaname started gathering the papers up and stuffing them back in her book bag. I'll need to have your plans for whatever it's going to be by Thursday morning so I can coordinate with whoever's in charge of the facilities it'll be using. Understood. Can you give me a hint? Negative. Fine, be that way. She finished packing up and paused, eyeing him thoughtfully. So, all these girls wanting to go to the dance with you. Yes. Are you going to? Of course not, Sosuke said flatly. As the event organizer, you'll have to be present in some official capacity. When you're out in public, I'm on duty. Oh, yeah, of course. Kaname went a bit red again and glanced away awkwardly. Then, to laugh it off, she said, I can't believe you didn't know they were asking you for a date. Dating is outside my occupational specialties, Sosuke replied. Yeah, well, so's a lot of stuff you ought to try, Kaname said. I'm going to be holed up in here working on Winterfest stuff for the rest of the week. You should go out one of these nights. What the hell are you talking about? She asked herself. Sosuke frowned as if only his inherent reserve was preventing him from asking the same thing. Then, brow still furrowed in puzzlement, he said, What would such a thing entail? Well, first you ask somebody, and if they say yes, then you set a time and... I don't know. There isn't really much of a nightlife around here, said Kaname, facing the awkward realization, now that he'd asked, that she really had no idea what one would do for a date on Gerardo. Go out for dinner, I guess. If you really wanted to make an occasion out of it, you'd go someplace fancy, where you wouldn't normally go. This might be a worthwhile reconnaissance operation, Sosuke mused. Perhaps Mr. Weeks. Kaname would have choked if she'd had a beverage, envisioning Sosuke going out on the town with DSM's one and only Karkaroid student, Frank Shark Week Weeks. Shark Week not only wasn't human, he wasn't even from a species that had gender, as humans understand it. He was only called he because he was way too laid back to insist on gender neutrality in a language that didn't really have a provision for it, and because he happened to have picked a masculine standard name when emigrating with his parents from Parathrox to New Avalon some years before. No, Sosuke, she said after taking a moment to get hold of herself again. A girl, or at least another humanoid life form, she qualified. Sosuke took that on board with his usual grave expression, then nodded and rose to his feet. Very well, he said, and then strode to the archway, with a startled Kaname trotting to keep up with him, and said to the nearest female schoolmate he recognized, Miss Tesla. Mileva Tesla skidded to a halt, breaking off from a conversation with her roommate, Irina Woods, and said, yes? Let's go on a date. Mileva blinked a couple of times, utterly baffled, then replied, okay? Kaname stared blankly at the two for several long seconds. What? Wednesday, February 10th, 2410. This is 10 different degrees of wrong, Kaname grumbled, pacing outside the elevator doors, waiting with Mileva Tesla for Sosuke to arrive. Bad enough that Mileva was the youngest person on her floor. She was 12, having been homeschooled up to this point by some of the most brilliant people in the galaxy. Bad enough that she was one of the relatively few other non-duelist students besides Sosuke who held a weapons permit from the campus security service. Bad enough that she was quick-witted, clever, almost relentlessly cheerful, and, despite what could only be seen as a very sheltered upbringing, outgoing. She also, on top of all that, happened to look great. Kaname wasn't one of those catty girls who could never bear to admit it when another girl looked good, and Maleva was looking very well turned out tonight, in a crisp white blouse under a peppy little Klein blue jumper dress, GI black cold weather tights, and smart but practical boots. She even had on a matching little Garibaldi hat at a rakish angle, which was more than a trifle old-fashioned, but somehow timeless on her. And over her arm she carried a navy blue wool pea jacket. She wasn't ravishing, not at 12, and possibly never, but with her big brown eyes, her perfectly straight nose, her short black hair, and her general air of fresh-scrubbed, clean-living wholesomeness, she was completely adorable. Kaname reminded herself firmly several times as they waited that this was a ridiculous thing to be resenting. And where had she learned to put on makeup, growing up surrounded by action scientists? The elevator dinged, the doors hissed open, and there was Sosuke. Instead of the usual DSM school uniform Kaname had grown used to seeing him in, he was wearing a garment she'd never seen before. Like a suit, but with a double-breasted, lapel-less jacket over a white shirt with a stiff, upright collar. The suit was dark charcoal gray and structured so that it managed to look casual and formal at the same time, which was, Kaname dimly recalled, the hallmark of some Seleucian fashion house or another. Emporio Armani di Senar, Seleucian fashion firm established 2005 by Giorgio Armani, an Earthman already famous on his homeworld for... Not now! Sosuke, unaware of the mild ripple he'd just caused in the collective psyche of a species, never mind among the students who just happened to be loitering in the lounge, nodded cordially. Miss Chittery. He then turned his attention to Maleva, and what he said next startled Kaname clean out of reflections on his fashion sense. Good evening, Miss Tesla. You look lovely. Maleva blinked. Clearly she hadn't expected him to say that either, but recovered quickly and thanked him with a slight blush, adding, "You clean up pretty good yourself." "Where did you steal that suit?" Kaname asked before she could stop herself. Sosuke didn't seem offended. He merely replied, matter-of-factly, "It's standard issue. When TechCom personnel are assigned to guard civilians, there's always the chance that we'll need to blend in on a higher social level than is usually encountered in everyday life." "Oh, so it's part of your spy gear?" "Essentially, yes," he said. "Shall we, Miss Tesla? Our table at Pellucidar is reserved for 1930 hours. "Remember, lockout is at 11, Kaname said. "That's 2300 to the military brain. And I don't want to find out tomorrow that you messed with the security system or teleported in after hours or some such craziness." She added sharply, though whether for Sosuke's benefit or Maleva's she couldn't have said. As she put on her jacket, Maleva only giggled and replied, not all that reassuringly, "Don't worry, Kaname. You won't." "We'll be back in plenty of time," Sosuke promised stolidly. "I'm uncomfortable about being out of fast return range for even that long." "I'm not going to be anywhere but the lounge and my room. Now go, before I change my mind," Kaname declared, gesturing to the elevator. Then she softened a little. Hell, it was probably Tesla's first date, no need to be such a tyrant about it, and said, "Have a good time." Once they were gone, Kaname returned to the war room, ensconced herself in the corner again, and resolutely buried herself in her work, determined to give the pair of them no further thought until they returned. Thursday, February 11th, 2410.
"Kwe, it's morning! Kwe, get up! Kwe, Kana-chan, you'll be late! Kwe!"
Kaname didn't think of herself as a morning person, and there was plenty of evidence to back up that assertion.
Kwe! Kwe! Good morning, Kana-chan. You'll be late.
It usually took two iterations of her alarm clock to even get her out of bed, and she couldn't be considered functionally ambulatory until after her morning shower. Fortunately for her, the women's bathroom and shower on Hamlin 4 was directly opposite her room, so she didn't have to worry about getting lost along the way. Getting dressed and getting packed for her morning classes was usually an automated process. Her clothes and books were laid out ahead of time and quickly taken care of. At that point, it was a simple matter to head out, board the elevator, and head down to the dining common on the first floor. Still ensconced in her little world, she barely registered that Sosuke wasn't present for breakfast. But he had to have gotten back in time because Maleva's check-in hadn't triggered any red flags or alarms. Therefore, it was not until she had consumed breakfast and was headed out the doors of Hannibal Hamlin Hall that she realized there had been a strange conversational undercurrent among the students in the dining hall. She tried to think of what it could be, but her mind had been much more preoccupied with the circumstances behind Maleva and Sosuke's date.
"Spirit, you're obsessing, Sterling," she chided herself. "If they had a good time, more power to them. It's not my business to pry." "Never mind, they're both my responsibility. And Sosuke has no clue what's really involved in a date. And Maleva's technically underage. Spirit of Light, what was I thinking?"
Kaname was so lodged in her dudgeon as she walked that she didn't notice Lindsay Willows approaching until she was beside the taller teen and poking her in the side. Kaname jerked, startled.
"Huh? What?"
"I said, hi, Kaname. Jeez, you're out of it today." Lindsay peered at Kaname thoughtfully. "You feeling all right?" Kaname grunted. "Had a late evening," she stated by way of explanation. "Still booting up." "All right," Lindsay conceded. She then continued, "I take it Sosuke and Maleva's date went okay, because otherwise there would have been at least two thermonuclear explosions last night, and we'd be due one this morning." "I wouldn't know," Kaname grumbled, looking away. "I'm the one under surveillance. Besides, what am I, the cruise director?"
"Maybe they're up on the Lido deck," she mentally continued. "Why do people keep bringing that up?"
Lindsay blinked. "Cribes, Kaname? No need to bite my head off." Kaname seemed to return to herself then. She shook her head to clear the mental static and looked back at her friend. "Sorry. Sorry. I've just got a lot on my mind, that's all." So I see. "I'm just waiting for the other shoe to drop," Kaname explained as they turned a corner to start walking along the North Commons path. "Sosuke still hasn't delivered on..." "What the hell is that?" Kaname came to an immediate halt, staring across the snow-covered common. The gently rolling terrain, cut by the deep blue line of the Little Neverwinter and crisscrossed by student paths, was a long familiar sight. The two thick, blocky structures that were now present at either end of the common? Those were new. Lindsay blinked. "That's a pretty big shoe." Slowly, as if in a dream, Kaname stepped out onto the common. Her mind continued to try and parse what she was seeing. At first glance, they looked like nothing less than block-built military bunkers, and indeed there was a definite air of brutal unsophistication to them. Getting closer, however, revealed interesting variations in the design that made the structures more than just bunkers. They seemed to be circular in shape, with slightly sloped outside edges. A ramp in one curved wall led up to the upper surface. Kaname supposed there would be a matching ramp on the opposite side. Up on top there were large, bulky barriers regularly spaced, like crenellations on an ancient fort, to serve as cover for whoever was on the roof. Climbing up the ramp was not difficult. The material it was made of looked to be akin to rather dirty snow, but it definitely supported her weight and Lindsay's.
Now on the roof, she could see that the change in altitude gave a nice view of the common and the matching structure on the opposite side in front of main administration. And if that wasn't high enough, there was even a sniper tower on one corner of the structure for better observation capability. An opening in the roof revealed an inner space, and it looked like it wouldn't be too dangerous to jump in if need be. Presumably there would be exits from the room inside. Scattered here and there, both up above and down below, were dumpster-like metal bins painted blue and evidently empty. Bright dots of color in the distance showed that the opposite fort was similarly equipped, but the bins over there were red. "Good morning, Miss Chittery," said Sosuke with an air of satisfaction. He stood at the base of the sniper tower, looking off toward the opposite fort through a pair of collapsible binoculars, apparently pleased with what he saw. Not far away, Mileva Tesla was speaking into a handy-talkie, evidently directing unseen activities within one of the two structures. "What is this?" Kaname asked, mystified. "What did you do?" Sosuke lowered his binoculars, turned to face her, and replied, "As you requested, Miss Tesla and I have solved the afternoon recreation gap." "This thing is the snow fort from hell." Sosuke nodded. "That was the basic idea, yes." He gestured toward the opposite fort. "If our calculations are correct, combining the innocent childhood pleasures of snowball fighting with the small unit tactics and teamwork of a basic capture-the-flag exercise should yield a most satisfactory afternoon's entertainment for the more physically inclined and competitive students." Appearing to digest that, Kaname sat down on one of the lower crenellations, then sprang up again in surprise. "What the... This isn't snow, it's rock hard!" "It's a composite material called pykrete. It was developed on Earth in the mid-20th century." Lindsay rapped experimentally on the smooth surface with a knuckle, then asked, "What's it made of?" "Ice, reinforced with sawdust. It's an economical and quick building material in sub-freezing conditions, and surprisingly resilient." Sosuke gestured to the front of the fort, which sloped sharply down to the common like the face of a dam. "This glacis would easily withstand up to 80mm mortar fire." "How are we going to get rid of these things after sanity weekends? Jackhammers?" "Not a problem. Miss Tesla and I have it all worked out." Crouching, Sosuke picked up a bulky object that had lain at his feet, concealed by the battlement at the base of the tower, and hefted it into view. Mileva wheeled over another, very similar object, this one mounted on a small cart. They were strange-looking things, part industrial tool, part weapon, with heavy-duty controls and a curious cowling at the front on which some jaunty soul had painted fighter-plane-style shark teeth. Kaname said nothing. "Seleucian issue M7057 defoliant projector for progressive meltdown," Mileva explained. "We start at the top, work our way down, job done. Should take about half an hour." "You're going to melt it with flamethrowers? What about the sawdust?" "Sawdust is flammable, Miss Chittery," Sosuke pointed out as if reluctant to believe she wasn't aware of so basic a fact. "Spirit, I am not having this conversation," Kaname muttered through her teeth, and then, out loud, "Lindsay, take me away from here before I do something Sosuke will regret." "You didn't ask," Lindsay observed cheerfully as they left the fort, "but I think this is going to be bitchin'." Friday, February 12th, 2410. 0043 hours. Kaname didn't really mind that the final push on the prep work for Winterfest had kept her in the corner bunker in the common room past midnight. She was getting a lot done, and starting to form real confidence that everything was, in fact, going to be ready in time. Besides, it was nice and quiet with everyone else on the floor in bed. Almost everyone else. Rory, she said flatly, without looking up from her work. In here, now. There was a pause. Then Rory Williams entered the room from the hallway, looking a bit sheepish. Hey, Kaname, he said with feigned bonhomie. Still hard at it, I see. Kaname held up a hand for him to wait and be quiet, used the other to finish filling in a form, then put her pen down, got up, and regarded him with an expression that was not so much annoyance as resignation. Rory, she said, then sighed. You have to stop sneaking in here after curfew every night. I mean, you're good at it, props for that, but my ass could end up in the sling with yours if you get caught. She put her hands on her hips. It's very dashing and romantic, I'm sure, but can you honestly not live without your girlfriend for a whole 8 hours a day? Seriously. I know you're not a frosh, you're only on my floor because the housing numbers were weird this year, but I can only cut you so much slack for that. You keep this up and I'm going to have to go to Dean Montaigne eventually. Rory raised a hand and opened his mouth to reply several times, each time frowning at himself and pacing away a few steps before returning to try it again. Finally, he stopped, looked her straight in the eye, and said, All right, look, I'll level with you. Amy and me? Kaname raised an eyebrow, wondering where this was heading, but in none of the scenarios she envisioned in the second or so before he went on did she come anywhere close to predicting what he actually said next. We're time travelers. We're not really 15. We've been together for something like 20 human lifetimes at this point. Sometimes we get separated. When that hasn't happened, we prefer to keep it that way as much as possible. He shrugged. So? Kaname looked back at his perfectly earnest face for a couple of seconds, her own expression completely blank. Then, finally, she couldn't hold back the laughter any longer and giggled her way back into her chair. All right, points for creativity. You're off the hook this time, but do me a favor and try to get back here by 11 most nights, huh? She shook her head, picked up her pen, and moved on to the next form. Good night, Rory. With a slight smile on his face, Rory sketched a salute. Mom, he said, and turned to go. And shave properly in the morning, she called after him. This is school, not a music video. Yes, Mom, he replied, followed by the sound of his room door opening and closing again. 16:57 hours. The assembled students milled about in the student union's grand ballroom, waiting for somebody to come and explain what was up with the two structures that had appeared on the common the previous day. A school-wide email had been issued stating that explanations would be forthcoming for anybody who wanted to hear them, but in order to hear them, they'd have to come to the ballroom at a certain time in the afternoon, and this was nearly that time. They didn't have to wait long. At 5 p.m., Kaname Sterling stepped out onto the ballroom's small stage, came to a halt behind the podium that was there, and composed herself. Hello, she declared, her voice amplified to reach the far corners of the great room. May I have your attention, please? The murmuring tapered off as everyone turned to face the stage. Ah, good. Well, she smiled cheerfully. Thank you all for coming. You know why we're here. Sanity Week is upon us, and we're going to kick it off in style with the 4th annual Winterfest. Kaname waited for the cheers this remark aroused to subside, then went on. Now, for those of you who've done this before, you can relax. We've got all the stuff you know and love from last year's Winterfest coming up. Ice boating, lake hockey, the cross-country ski race, it's all in there. Full details are available in the schedule packets you should all have found in your mailboxes this morning. She held up an example of the colorful publication in question, in case anyone hadn't grasped what they were. However, this year we're also going to try something new. You may have noticed, she added dryly, the ice structures that have been erected out on the common. Well, it's not some kind of weird avant-garde art installation. That's the venue for an experimental new Winterfest event. She took one hand off the lectern and gestured grandly to her right, where a simple, idealized, slightly cartoonish hollow of the two ice bunkers and the no-man's land in between them appeared. We call it Snow Gulch. After giving her audience a few seconds to take in the hollow, Kaname stepped from behind the lectern and paced in front of it, explaining as she did so. Semi-organized snowball fights are a Winterfest tradition, but Snow Gulch is a snowball fight with a difference. You will divide into two teams, codenamed Red and Blue. Preliminary selections to be made now, final rosters must be posted by dinner time tomorrow. Professor Moore will be faculty supervisor for Red, Professor McGregor for Blue, but internal organization of those teams, chains of command, if any, area of responsibility, and so forth, are entirely up to you. At 1 p.m. on Sunday, the teams will report to their obvious rallying points, and the game will begin. The hollow switched from an isometric perspective to the view from the blimp, enabling Kaname to point out various blinking waypoints. This will be a simple capture-the-flag exercise, with which many of you are no doubt familiar from all that online gaming you do when you're supposed to be studying. That got a mild, vaguely guilty laugh, as Kaname pointed out the flashing red and blue triangles in the centers of the two forts. On the off chance that anyone doesn't know how this works, each team will have an obvious and accessible token in a central location, she said. You are not allowed to remove your own token from its designated area. The object of the game is to enter the opposing team's fortification, seize their token, and convey it back to your own fort without losing your own token. To illustrate this point, the red triangle left its place in the red fort, moved across the battlefield, and took up a position next to the blue triangle. When one team has both tokens in their central holding area, the other team will have 2 minutes to remove one or both from that area. If they do not succeed in doing so, the team holding both tokens is awarded a point, the round ends, the tokens will be reset, and a new round begun. Really getting into the general on the stage thing now, Kaname turned back and paced toward the lectern, her hands folded behind her back. We'll start with a couple of rounds with small test teams just to make sure the system works and there are no unforeseen glitches with the scoring. If all goes well, all hands battles will follow. Play will continue until 3 rounds with the full teams are complete, or until dark, whichever comes first. At the end of that time, the team with the most points is the winner. In the event of a tie because we ran out of time, the referees may make a decision based on creativity, team spirit, casualty rates, or other factors, or we might put it to a vote. Sportsmanship is expected. Having gone up and down a couple of times, Kaname arrived in front of the middle of the hollow again, turned to face the audience fully, and said, "And that brings me to the most important rule. Your only weapon, and I cannot possibly stress this enough, will be snow. That's it. No other means of attack will be permitted. You can be as creative as you want about how you employ it, but the only thing I want to see hitting people out there is snow, and not snow packed so tightly it's basically ice. And a bit of light wrestling is okay in close combat, but no brawling. I know some of you people can get pretty competitive." That drew another laugh. "But this isn't actually a war, so control yourselves. It's supposed to be fun. If anybody gets hurt, we won't be doing this again." She held her firm gaze on them for a few seconds, letting that sink in, then smiled to break up the tension. "Any questions?" She nodded to the owner of the first hand up. "Yes, Frank." "What about equipment?" Frank Weeks asked. "You said we could be creative. Does that mean we're allowed to make things?" "Well spotted, yes," said Kaname. "You are allowed to build devices that throw snow, if you think of any. Just a couple of things. They either have to be fixed in position, in which case, go nuts, or they have to be small and light enough that one or two people, no more, can carry and operate them. And you have to be able to make them out of stuff that's readily available on campus in the next day.
Anything you build has to be vetted by the referees by the team selection deadline tomorrow.
What about a trebuchet? Someone asked.
Kaname laughed.
Sure, if you can build one by 6 o'clock tomorrow night, she said.
There were a few other questions, mainly procedural. Then she turned them loose to set up their teams, and the gathering dissolved into what looked from a distance like chattering chaos as the students began to discuss the matter animatedly among themselves. Kaname smiled with satisfaction as she watched the mass of students break up into smaller clusters, as teams were formed and battle lines drawn. Everyone seemed excited, which she took as a good sign, and she found herself looking forward to this crazy idea coming to fruition more than she might have expected she would before delivering the briefing.
Not bad, not bad at all, Lindsay commented as Kaname dismounted from the stage to land on the ballroom floor.
Our most famous alumna couldn't have done it better herself.
You know, Linz, I think you may be right. This is going to be bitchin', Kaname said with a wink.
And I should hope so. I've had plenty of practice.
The two went out into the room, half listening to snippets of various groups' negotiations as they began to form coalitions and build up into what would become the two armies. Sosuke, who had hovered off to the side during the briefing, joined them.
Mileva's idea appears to be a popular one, he said, sounding gratified. I look forward to seeing it in practice.
Will you be playing? Lindsay wondered.
Negative, Miss Willows. My experience in these matters would give me an unfair advantage.
Oh, pff, said Kaname. It's an organized snowball fight, not the Battle of Debney Ridge. I bet some of these kids are way better at it than you are.
That sounds challenge-like to me, Lindsay observed.
I suppose I could moderate my participation, Sosuke allowed after a moment's consideration.
It would be a useful opportunity to observe the other students' performance in a simulated crisis.
There, you see? You can even turn fun time into work, said Kaname.
Also, hang on, she's Mileva now? What happened to Miss Tesla?
Sosuke glanced at her, then replied with a perfectly straight face.
She asked me to call her Mileva. It's only polite to comply.
What, so all I have to do is tell you to stop calling me Miss Chittery?
Negative. The situation is very different. You're not a girl. You're my assignment.
Kaname sighed.
Get out of here before I hurt you.
Sosuke nodded.
Affirmative. Excuse me while I make preparations.
As he was turning to go, the three passed the very girl they'd just been talking about, standing with her roommate Irina. They'd have gone on by, except that Kaname happened to catch the word Panzer in their conversation. Looking over her shoulder at the two youngsters, Kaname proclaimed,
"No tanks!"
Irina looked crestfallen.
"Aw, but Mileva and I were hoping..."
"No. Just... no."
The school's Panzer 26 would be inappropriate for the terrain and environment anyway, Sosuke observed helpfully. "You would be much better served with a Napoleon-class microtank. Their turrets can be easily swapped out." Kaname glared at Sosuke.
"Don't encourage them!"
"I thought encouraging the younger students to push their limits was part of an upperclassman's responsibility," Sosuke protested mildly, and Lindsay burst out laughing at the look on Kaname's face as she realized he'd just played back something she had said.
"Go!"
Kaname commanded, pointing imperiously in a randomly chosen direction. Sosuke, with the faintest hint of a smile, saluted and took himself off to do something out of her way for a while. Irina and Mileva departed in another direction, revising their plans as they went. Mizuki and Aba drifted out of the crowd, arriving just as the other three left, and inquired cheerfully,
"Trouble with Electric Girl and Bomb Boy?"
Rolling her eyes, Kaname sighed.
"That kid's a bad influence."
"Who? Sagara or Tesla?" Mizuki asked.
Kaname flatly replied,
"Yes." Lindsay considered this for a moment, then opined, "He encourages her to think bigger. She encourages him to think non-linearly. That's a terrifying kind of feedback loop. I think we need to separate them for the galaxy's protection."